This podcast is Challenging Opinions and is presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading the Challenging Opinions podcast for June 25th, 2018. The conservative movement or movements have been hugely influential in the US, but do they really have any common unifying ideology throughout history? Or are they just the slow lane of the road to the development of our current society? Let's ask a historian of conservatism.
Challenging Opinions is the podcast where ideas are tested. Whether you are left or right, conservative or progressive, devout or skeptic, what matters is the strength of your argument, not the strength of your voice.
And coming up for you in this podcast, how far would you have to go back in time before you'd say this thing that in this time is labeled as conservatism is repugnant to me?
Is repugnant in my view, you mean?
In your view, yeah.
That what?
So for example, if you went back to the 1950s when it was normal for conservatives to argue that interracial marriage should be illegal, would you be comfortable with that?
No. Not personally, but...
But that was the dominant view among conservatives at the time. And that's coming up shortly, but first. Lawyers, the story goes, were originally paid by the word when they were writing legal texts. And that's the supposed reason why they write in a long-winded jargon that's often impossible for anyone else to understand. Lawyers say that they need to be exact, and they do, but they're certainly never afraid to call a shovel a manual digging implement suitable for the displacement of building material. So there aren't many legal texts that you would read for pleasure, but there's one. If, in the whole of your life, you only read one legal text for pleasure, or, in the whole of your life, you only read one legal text at all, I've got the one for you. It's a real legal text. It's the judgment of a real judge in a real court. The judge is Chief Justice J.D. Rook, and the judgment was delivered in 2012 in the Court of Queen's Bench in Alberta, Canada. And it's not short either. The main document is about 150 pages. But it's worth reading, honestly. Even if you're not a lawyer, especially if you're not a lawyer. The case is called Meads versus Meads. I've got a link to it in the show notes, and it doesn't sound like it should be that interesting because it's a case that arises out of a divorce, but I promise you, it's well worth reading. The reason it's worth reading is because Larry Meads, one of the litigants, is what's called a freeman on the land. This is a weird cross between a contrick, a cult, and a conspiracy theory. It's related to the sovereign citizen movements, and when you read the judgment, you get a sense of the exasperation that the judge went through in hearing the case, and the forensic takedown that he did of the freeman on the land ideology. And this is a deeply deluded ideology. In case you don't know, the freeman on the land ideology has a weird and shifting mix of beliefs that center around the assertion that the government doesn't exist or is just a private company, and that their laws don't exist or are just terms of a private contract that they can opt out of, basically that all laws are optional. They hold that there are millions of dollars held in some secret government bank accounts and that they can force the government to make everyone rich if they can only explain their case to the right judge. Freemen on the land also believe that by using strange phrasing, they can almost magically make themselves exempt from all laws, get out of paying their debts, and make other people liable to pay them millions in damages for imaginary wrongs such as saying their name out loud. They have taken up huge amounts of court time making complicated and daft demands to try to enforce what they claim are their rights, and making complaints against every court official who tries to deal with them. Needless to say, this is all nonsense and they never win, but the most interesting thing is the language they use. Chief Justice Rook calls Larry Meads and a host of other freemen on the land believers organized pseudo-legal commercial argument, or OPCA, litigants. He's clearly put a lot of research into his ruling, and he lists some of the dafter linguistic backflips that these Freemen on the Land, OPCA litigants, have performed. Some of them have become obsessed with something they call Admiralty Law, and believe that various legal terms have been devised to trick them into giving up their rights, and have some connection with seafaring for some reason. So they talk about citizenship, as in a ship being like a ship that sails on the sea, and they talk about the dock in a court being related to a dock in a harbour or a birth certificate. They spell it B-E-R-T-H again, as in a harbour. That's only the beginning of their attack on language, and their way with words is a hugely complicated mumbo-jumbo in a pastiche of legalese. It's far too mind-numbing even to begin discussing on a podcast, but Justice Rook identifies the reason behind it. People like Larry Meads, who end up in court thinking that they will have some magical way of winning a case, they're the victims of con men who charge a lot of money to produce nonsense documents filled up with this stuff. The mumbo-jumbo is never designed to impress the court. It's designed to impress simpletons into parting with their money. In any case, don't take my word for it. The link is on the website. It's a fantastic read.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, email podcast@challengingopinions.com and say what you think.
Hello, I'm Calvin Halk, and this is
Eric Ladwig, and we are
a podcast about something. We like to tackle your favorite subjects in the entertainment world, the sports world. What are some of the things we've talked about here so far?
We've talked everything from NFL Draft to Infinity War recently, so if you like those things, you go ahead and you click on some of our available episodes.
You can listen to us on Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn. Subscribe, and also follow us on Twitter @APASomething. Thanks for listening.
On the line now, I have Dr. Gregory L. Schneider. He's the professor of history at Emporia State University. He's also the author of a number of books, including one that I was interested in, The Conservative Century, From Reaction to Revolution, Critical Issues in American History. That was published in 2008. Gregory, I know you've done some other books since then, but when you talk about the conservative century, you're referring essentially to the 20th century, is that right?
Yeah, so you could joke and say I'm referring to the Middle Ages, but I'm not. I'm referring to the 20th century, to the point in which American conservatism tended to shape itself in reaction initially to progressivism and to New Deal liberalism, but then afterward in putting together its own intellectual and political movements, which contributed to the Reagan Revolution and to the changes which have come about in America since that time.
Okay. If you said, if you define it as that century, then you obviously have a start point. Does that mean the end of the 20th century is an end point in some way for conservatism?
No, I the book goes through the Bush years at the time. But I think now I'm beginning to wonder about my basic argument, let me go back to that, is that conservatism has been a remarkably protean idea throughout the 20th century, that it's shifted its perspectives over time, that in the early 20th century it was kind of hostile to the masses.
Yeah, you've actually, Gregory, got to a question I was going to ask you. So let me put it.
Okay.
Does conservatism actually exist, or is it just something different at any given in any given context?
Well, I think it exists over three basic premises. That it is upholding of the constitutional order, of course, and very defensive of that order as coming from the American founding tradition. Certainly it has a basis in Judeo-Christian religious values and beliefs, as well as it kind of needs an enemy, it seems. If you think about over the course of the 20th century, that enemy was, of course, communism during its high point, I think, of American conservatism, which I would date from the 50s through the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And then since then, it's been floundering because it hasn't had an enemy to replace it. I mean, certain aspects of conservatives believe that it's Islamic fundamentalism. Others don't. Others believe that it's modern liberalism or progressivism. Mm-hmm. Others don't. I mean, you have this conflicted notion that really goes on throughout the 20th century, where conservatives are arguing with each other more as much as they're arguing with other people and other movements that they're opposed to. But it hasn't been able to kind of reshape itself, I think, in any coherent way since the end of the Cold War. So the Reagan years are oftentimes seen, quite correctly probably, as the apogee of modern conservatism in America.
Okay. The reason I asked whether it actually exists or whether, you know, what is called conservatism now is the same as what took that name 50 years ago or 100 years ago. You're clearly coming at that topic from a sympathetic point of view. You identify as a conservative. How far would you have to go back in time? How far would you have to go back in time before you'd say this thing that in this time is labeled as conservatism is repugnant to me?
Is repugnant in my view, you mean?
In your view, yeah.
That what?
So for example, if you went back to the 1950s, maybe early 1960s, when it was normal for conservatives to argue that interracial marriage should be illegal and that discrimination in the provision of goods and services should be legal, would you be comfortable with that?
No, not personally. But
that was the dominant view among conservatives at the time.
There were some conservatives who were shaped by the Southern, by the kind of states' rights elements in the South. Mm-hmm. William F. Buckley wrote a couple of articles for National Review about this, but this wasn't the whole basis of conservative beliefs. The main issues in American conservatism was not opposition to the civil rights movement. Certainly the conservatives, I think, draw the wrong conclusions from the civil rights movement, that it's linked to communism and it's linked to, it's threatening to American values and order. Mm-hmm. That's a tragic element of American conservatism, I would agree. However, the main issues in which conservatives organized were around the issue of communism, around the issue of the modern state and its threats to constitutional order and to free market economy. So I don't think that it's fair to say that the states' rights elements were the key parts of American conservatism. I know there are historians who've made that argument, but I don't think when you look at the when you look at the entirety of the history of National Review and you look at the entirety of the history of Buckley and other thinkers in American conservatism, it just doesn't weigh out.
You're correct to identify states' rights as one of the things that has shifted, perhaps, in the political scene. I think it's probably fair to say that states' rights was a code for saying that Southern states did not have to conform to the Civil Rights Act, or should not have to conform to that. But would you say that if you were traveling backwards in time, putting states' rights aside, there's nothing else that you would find problematic?
Not much. No, I treat this in the book not as a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. I think my work has been critical of conservatives while sympathetic to it. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly people I disdain who I write about in the conservative century, in the early period of what I call conservatism. Nobody called themselves that. But there are people like Ralph Adams Cram, who's an anti-modernist architect, mm-hmm. who's referring to most people as Neolithic. Now, I don't agree with that or identify with that. I don't think there's any conservative who would identify with that today. Mm-hmm. The problem is, how does that position change and morph into something that's much more pro-democratic and much more pro-masses through the course of the 20th century? That's what I investigated. It wasn't
To go to another topic, Gregory, it wasn't uncommon up to the 1960s for states, and by no means restricted to the south of the United States, in fact, more so perhaps in New England, to have very strict laws against contraception and abortion. Would you have agreed with those at the time or now?
Well, my personal views on those don't matter. The point is that there were laws like this, so it's the historian's job to assess those in a fair manner, mm-hmm. not to apply his frame of reference or her frame of reference from today to the past. So
That's a fair point. But my point is that at the time, there was a battle between what were actually even called at the time conservatives and liberals, and the liberals said that the state has no business interfering in what people do in their bedroom. And the Conservatives said that in order to preserve the moral order, we have to make sure that contraception is illegal. And I can't really see how, I can't see very many, certainly no mainstream Conservatives in the 21st century having any sympathy in public with that argument.
Well, I mean, I think that there were Conservatives. I'm not sure if they were people who would become who you would find to be representative of the conservative movement that I wrote about in the book. I mean, Ronald Reagan, as governor of California, passes the first kind of no-fault divorce law in California, you know, under his term. So, and yet Reagan is seen as kind of a religious conservative, which I think Trump actually outdoes him on, and Bush outdid him on in many respects is in current parlance. So my point is that I don't think this shapes the movement. I mean, these are episodes, of course, which I can't really comment on in terms of who you mean to be opposed to those sorts of things. But my point is that those aren't the shaping forces of the conservative movement in America. The shaping forces are hostility to big government, constitutional, defense of constitutional order, certainly Judeo-Christian principles, as well as anti-communism.
To go specifically on that, when, for example, in the late 19th century, there were laws brought in about work safety, so that, for example, machines that were dangerous had to have guards on them so that a worker's hand wasn't pulled in and they were mutilated. This was criticized at the time as an interference by government in a private relationship between an employer and an employee. You understand what I'm getting at. I don't want to make you responsible for all the sins of the conservatives of the past, but you can understand what I mean, that if you look at what are called conservatives today, there's a good argument to say that they would not have been considered conservatives in a previous era. You might actually say that they're just the slow learners class of liberals.
No, what I'm saying is that, yeah, I mean, I use the term laissez-faire conservatives to define the late 19th century industrial, the kind of defenders of the industrial order, from anybody from William Graham Sumner to Andrew Carnegie and others, who saw as their duty to defend the kind of laissez-faire economics then predominating. Of course, there's plenty of problems with that argument because they receive benefits from the government too, indirectly. No income tax, no corporate tax to speak of. The fact that the government cannot intervene in the private relations between the employer and the employee. I mean, that obviously begins to shift because of the progressive movement. The question becomes not so much that I think conservatives are hostile to workers losing their hands in factories, but how much power do you accord the government to intervene in regulating these issues and affairs? That becomes the central question. And it's not just on labor, it's a whole slew of things, whether it's the government's job to regulate railroads and how effectively they do that, which is subjects I'm working on today. The development of the administrative state in the early 20th century is something that a lot of conservative scholars now are focusing quite a bit of attention on. This is not the welfare state, but it certainly is the beginnings of the kind of bureaucratic state which has become predominant in Western Europe as well as in America as well. So these sorts of things are topics which I think are fair to be contested. I couldn't contest personally, of course, anybody losing their hand in a job or anybody suffering personal injuries. I mean, what was happening 100 years ago in the industrial level would certainly not happen today. And not be contested by somebody.
I know that you had a chance to listen to Jay Townsend, who was on the podcast back in January. He's a Republican, or mostly Republican political consultant, the sort of person who advises people who want to get into Congress or whatever, what ads to run and what tactics to take. But he's been in the game a long time. He's a relatively elderly guy. And he spoke almost despairingly about the current state of the Republican Party, I can't remember his phrase exactly, but he basically said that they've become monomaniacs on reducing taxation and not interested in anything else. Do you think that was a valid criticism?
I think there were some rightful criticism of that I mean, Trump did pass the tax. I don't think Trump's a monomaniac when it comes to taxes. I mean, I think he's certainly no conservative when it comes
Trump
to...
Trump isn't, but perhaps the Republican Party, the mainstream Republican Party is.
Yeah, I think there's a fetish in the Republican Party for, not all of it, of course, but for a certain conservative wing of it, to believe that tax cuts are the solution to every problem. And that's been, certainly there's been evidence that's beneficial to the economy. There's also detriments to this as well. And any honest person would have to say that there's a balancing act that you have to apply here, mm-hmm. When it comes to these sorts of concerns. There is certainly a tendency to favor free market solutions rather than government ones. So the government ones are oftentimes much more expensive. The free market ones don't provide enough coverage, let's say, on healthcare or other things of that sort. I mean, there's problems, of course, with all of that stuff. I think that what Mr. Townsend wasn't recognizing is how much the Republican Party shifted over the past 30 to 40 years. I mean, it's no longer, in some respects, the party of Reagan. It's kind of similar to how the Democrats dealt with FDR. William Luckenberg, who was a historian, wrote a book in the shadow of FDR about how every Democrat tried to live up to the four-term, hero of the World War II and the Depression. How do you do that? How do you fall prey to doing more than him, let's say, in the case of Lyndon Johnson, or doing less of than him in the case of, let's say, Jimmy Carter? Mm-hmm. And these are dilemmas which every party faces. Reagan has become, in that same vogue, the Republican FDR to some extent, and it's a difficult task for certain groups of Republicans to fill his shoes. The most interesting thing about, of course, Trump's election is that Trump wasn't trying to, and Trump is sui generis when it comes to his need for the Republican Party, because he is a base he himself helped develop, and he's not really betoken anybody in the GOP for it. And either the GOP will go along with it, which in some cases it has, or they'll revolt, and you'll have further fracturing on the right occurring. This has been ongoing in both parties, really, since the 1960s. The fracturing and kind of remaking up of the parties, the movement of various groups and ethnicities and identity groups to one side or the other. I mean, this has been a protean character all of its own in some respects in both parties, which I think Townsend hit on in his podcast.
I think you're right. But one question, I honestly don't know the answer, and I don't know whether you do or not, but do you regard Trump as a conservative?
No, not really. I think Trump, to me, comes across as a New York Republican, which I by that I don't mean Rockefeller Republican necessarily, though he comes to mind a little bit. Trump's not averse to spending, obviously. We're going to have some pretty big deficits as a result of spending that Trump has proposed and Republicans have gone along with.
And a space force, apparently.
Right. And I think that on that level, but on certain other things, Trump is instinctually conservative. There's no doubt that his nationalism is a conservative kind of trope, if you will. His push for patriotism is sometimes as ill thought out as it is part of that. I don't see him as a conservative in the line of the thinkers that and the politicians that I describe in my book. Mm-hmm. He's different, but he's different in a way that is because of where he comes from, because of the background he has, because of what he's long recognized, and there has been relatively long recognition on his part, at least since the 80s, when I've seen interviews with him talking about similar themes about the decline of manufacturing and the like, of some of the problems that face the country and what people are legitimately concerned about.
One thing that you mentioned when you gave your list of tick boxes for what makes a conservative was upholding a constitution. Would you trust Trump on that?
Yes. I think in that regard, he's probably as conservative as any of them. I mean, he's following the conservative movements, the Federalist Society and other groups who've been pushing the judges that he's been appointed on that regard. On other things, I won't comment on the Russia investigation and matter of that sort. I mean, that's for somebody who studies that more than I do. I don't study the
Well, just on the narrow issue of him claiming that he's entitled to pardon himself from any crimes he may have committed.
I really can't speak to that. I would say he could probably do it, but would it be politically wise to do it or politically wise to say it? And this is what's Trump's problem, isn't it? In a way, he's not a politician in the same way that a Reagan or Bush or other conservatives have been politicians. So he doesn't come out of politics. He comes out of business. He's never had to answer anybody. He's never had a board of directors. Mm-hmm. He's always been his own boss. So in some respects, he's used to giving the orders and he's used to dealing with these certain things in his own way. And off-the-cuff approaches seems to be the way he deals with them best. And they certainly might spark interest in his base, who don't really know what powers the presidents have in that regard, but certainly it makes him look rather silly on a number of levels, and maybe rather dangerous, too, if he goes ahead and does that. I don't think he will. I mean, I think part of this is what we're learning about Trump as we go along here, is Trump likes to shoot off at the cuff, sees what the reaction is, and then back away. Mm-hmm. And that's oftentimes what seems to happen.
That's true, and there is a discussion to be had as to whether that is as useful a trait in a politician as it is in a businessman. But I don't want to go down that particular road. I don't want to go down that road with you, especially because it's not your specialist area. But just very simply, Trump, that is to say, the administration, spending millions and millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money on Trump-owned properties in order to facilitate his very extensive golf playing, so that, for example, Secret Service people, the Secret Service has to pay Trump-owned properties large amounts of money on the basis of the decision that Trump has gone to play golf there. That's the sort of thing that would make the founding fathers turn in their graves, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the whole modern presidency, starting with FDR, would have made the founders roll over in their grave. So I'm not going to excuse Trump's overuse of Air Force One and his trips to Mar-a-Lago to play golf and all the other things he does. Mm-hmm. But every president's done this in the modern era, and Congress, who appropriates the purse, has allowed them to do it. And the presidency
presidents may have wasted money, but I think it is absolutely unprecedented for presidents to have effectively diverted taxpayers' money, large amounts of taxpayers' money, into their own pockets.
I mean, that I can't really comment on, because I'm not following Trump's, Trump that closely in terms of what he's doing in terms of his own personal business issues and the like.
Can comment generally on it. That is, for example, the Obama era. If you watched Fox News, Obama couldn't scratch his ear without Fox News finding a commentator saying that this was an unprecedented abuse of the Constitution. And they've gone very quiet on defense of the Constitution in the past couple of years. The off-the-cuff nature of Trump is appealing in some ways, and it may even reap rewards in some ways. But those constitutional limitations on the president and also on Congress and so forth, they were put there for a very good reason. And I would have thought that conservatives had a very good handle on that. And that's, you know, one of the, to the extent that I'm sympathetic to conservatives, that's one of the topics that I'm most sympathetic on, that they say, you know, those rules are there for a reason. They've been there for hundreds of years. Tossing them out on a whim is not a good thing to do, is it?
I think there are critics who've said this, who are the ones who tend to be the never-Trumpers, probably, in certain respects. There are,
until 2 years ago, that was all conservatives.
Sure. Well, or at least when Obama's president. I mean, isn't this the pattern when you have a president of your own party or somebody who's now, this is the fracturing of the society, too, and even the media. So now CNN's obsessed with Trump, and Fox News isn't. And if the Democrat wins in 2020, Fox News will be obsessed with the Democrat, and CNN won't. Yep. I mean, this is kind of the nature. That's why I don't take what they're doing as all that seriously, because I think a lot of what they're doing is too political, which becomes the problem. This is part of the problem of modern life, is that everything has become too political. from sports to culture to movies to just about everything under the sun has been politicized in a manner that's pretty depressing. And a conservative would say that this is part of the problem. A conservative would be suspicious of that kind of power being, this is what I think you're getting at, I agree with. Mm-hmm. A conservative would be upset with that kind of power being in the hands of any single person, of course. And it's certainly a constitutional conservative who would find that the founders had the right framework for vesting power and checks and balances in these institutions. That conservative constitutionalist would also find it reprehensible, as he should have, to vest the power of investigatory bodies in a special counsel, whether it was, as it was in the 90s, Ken Starr, mm-hmm. or whether now Robert Mueller. These sorts of extra constitutional prerogatives are troubling as well to conservatives who are honest about it, to find both when they're investigating a Democrat or they're investigating a Republican to be problematic. So, on that level, I would agree that these are troubling aspects. I don't know enough about, the certain aspects that you're raising to make any comments. All I do know is that the politicization of American life has become one of the most depressing aspects of the modern era.
I'm not sure about that. I think that every area of life can be political. And I'm finished just on one topic. You'll be aware of the gay marriage debate and the resistance against that, particularly one state official, Kim Davis, who was then supported by Mike Huckabee and other, what one would have thought were mainstream, very conservative voices. She was hired to do a job. She decided not to do the job that she was hired to do. Now, normal people would think that what you have to do then is, if you are not able to do the job that you're hired to do, that you resign. But she wanted to keep taking her salary and not do her job. Conservatives never seem to have a problem with that. Is there maybe a lack of integrity there that people, and might be on both sides, but that people are unwilling to call out hypocrisy or contradictions on their own side?
Well, I think this is the problem with when you tend to political. What happened with American conservatism, I would contend, is that it became too political. So they had success. That success emanated from Washington. It later spread to Congress and under Newt Gingrich, and then it later began to spread to state legislatures under groups that were able to fund more conservative legislators who won seats. Mm-hmm. During the Obama years. And you heard a lot about ALEC, which yes. was one of these big organizations, the American Legislative Exchange Council and other groups like that.
Yeah, what they do is they effectively write, ALEC, I should just say for listeners, ALEC effectively write model legislation, which they then persuade
model legislation
all conservatives in all state houses and senates to pass, and with the effect that
correct.
You get copy and paste legislation that shows up in many different states.
Right. And then you raise politics to this level where it's a war. So just like a war, you have to win. It's become a zero-sum game. And both sides do this. It's not just the conservative side. The conservatives are playing the same game as the liberals are, or progressives are. And if politics is a zero-sum game in which there's no consensus, there's no ability to shape a consensus, look at the frustration you get from politicians who are in Washington who leave routinely after one or two terms in office. Because they can't shape anything, they can't get anything done. I'm not saying that there was a better, that somehow there was this golden age of American politics in which I think John McCain and others are talking about, in which all of these people got together behind closed doors and shaped legislation. Obviously, there was a reaction against that mm-hmm. because that allowed the outsiders, the grassroots groups in the parties to have more influence than the party itself. So, maybe in the end this is all cyclical, but right now we're in an era certainly where the focus seems to be on the warlike atmosphere of politics, and both sides play this to the hilt. So that when something comes along, like the example you gave of the official in Pennsylvania, the conservatives aren't going to take the view of the progressives, even though they might agree with the basic issues, because to take the view of the progressives means they're costing one of their conservative constituents a seat. And they can't handle that, and vice versa on the progressive side. So, this is a game both sides are playing. I think it's one of the worst features of our contemporary politics.
Dr. Gregory Schneider, Professor of History at Emporia State University, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Make your view heard. Email podcast@challengingopinions.com to set out your ideas and defend them on the next podcast.
Go to the website for sources and links to Gregory's books and articles. And while you're there, please like the show on Facebook, follow @ChallengingO on Twitter, and get in touch with me if you can suggest a guest or topic for a future show. Also, you can find out how to subscribe to the podcast for free on your computer, your phone, or by email. It's all at www.challengingopinions.com. And I now have a Patreon account, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, I'd really appreciate that. All the details are on the website. Coming up next Monday, that's July 2nd, I'll be talking to Jeffrey Myron, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at Harvard. The Challenging Opinions podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.